So here we are this morning trying to find the why in the scriptures, and we're in the book of Matthew. Today, if you got a Bible, please pull that open there. You can start looking ahead and thinking about what you think. Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 to 28. So again, I really encourage you, if you have a Bible or device, I would pull that open. That's just me. So I want to begin here today, of course, as always, with some context. You got to keep in mind, I keep saying this, how I read the Bible is I think of it as a movie, okay? That's the best way. Then you can start creatively thinking, why is this here now? And if you remember last week, Alan talked about the leaven or the yeast of the scribes and Pharisees and how Jesus warns his disciples against letting that in. And Alan showed that one of the most insidious outcomes or results of their teaching was this laser focus on our faults or people's faults instead of on God's forgiveness. Does everyone remember that?
Yes.
Okay, that was big time. And you know, it makes it really obvious why Jesus didn't want his disciples to get caught up in all this nonsense of Pharisaic false religion, because it takes away the center of what Christ came to do. And as Alan mentioned last week, the Pharisees, what they were wanting from Jesus is a sign from heaven to prove the validity of what Jesus was saying and doing. And it's a really odd timing for that, because Jesus just finished feeding total 9,000 people miraculously. I would think that that's a pretty decent sign. How about you? Right? Like, where's that supposed to come from? But the reality is, it wasn't the kind of sign that they were looking for. They wanted a sign, said Alan, to fit their mold, an undisputable sign from heaven. I guess feeding wasn't that. Like raining down fire to destroy their enemies. That's a heaven sign, right? Because for them, you got to understand, compassion and mercy were not signs of the kingdom that they wanted to come. And so Jesus, for the second time, tells them that the only sign that they're going to get is the sign of
Jonah.
Okay, and I talked about that once before, because this is obviously the second time. So you can go listen to the sermon on Matthew 12 if you want major details on that. But the gist of it is the reminder that Jonah was famous for despising God's mercy towards his enemies. Right? What does he say once Nineveh, God relents of his calamity to Nineveh? What does Jonah say? You guys remember? What's that?
I knew you'd do that.
Yeah, and then he says, I would rather die. Right? It's very dramatic, okay? Well, what happens next in that story, if you guys know the end, check out the book of Jonah if you haven't checked it out. It's such a great story, okay? Jonah's concern is justice. He wants justice to be brought down on these guys. Instead, they get mercy, okay? And at the very end of the story, this is what happens. God grows a plant to shade Jonah from the sun, and the book says that he did so to save Jonah from his discomfort. Okay, he's having a fairly tough time. And Jonah's so happy for that comfort, it says that he was rejoicing in this plant. He really liked that plant a lot. So God sends a worm that eats the plant, right? And which worms do, and the plant withers and it decays and dies, okay? Then Jonah once again says, I'm so angry about the plant, I want to die. Jonah sounds like me, okay? Very dramatic person, okay? Now, what was Jonah so angry about, though? Why was he so angry about the plant? Okay, why did God send it? He sent it to relieve Jonah's discomfort. Okay, Jonah's mad when that's taken away from him. So his loss of comfort enrages him. And Yahweh makes a point to him. He says this, Jonah chapter 4, you pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in a night and perished in a night. And should not I pity Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle? Isn't it fascinating that God's concerned for cattle? Fascinating. Anyway, the interesting bit here is Yahweh points out that Jonah's Jonah pities the plant, but shows no pity for the city. Pity, of course, is the Hebrew word for compassion. Yahweh, the God of compassion, we've talked about this again and again, says to Jonah, you suffer, right? What's compassion? To suffer with. You suffer because the plant was destroyed. But you feel no suffering and nothing for an entire city of people. Jonah suffered from self-pity, but he had absolutely no pity at all for the city. He wouldn't spend one moment of suffering on them. Now, why is this so instructive? Because it seems to me Jesus is saying the Pharisees are Jonah-like people. How can they see crowds upon crowds of people receive compassionate help and yet think nothing of it, or even worse, despise it and say, that is not a work of God? That's not proof that heaven's breaking in. It seems to me that Jesus is putting this sign on them as proof that they never learned the lesson of Jonah. Okay, it's a sign to them, undisputable proof from heaven, that they've become an adulterous generation, says Jesus. They've entered relationship with a heartless God, some totally other God than the God that they originally came to know. Now, I want you to keep that movie in your mind as we come to the passage here today. Does that make sense? Okay. Very important background. Now, starting at verse 13. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter replied, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. Now, did you guys notice something really weird that he said to Peter there? Did it stand out to anybody? Son of Jonah. Son of Jonah, okay? Simon Bar-Jonah, which means Bar is son of, okay? Simon, son of Jonah. Did you know that this is the only time Peter is called that in the entire Bible? Okay? We know this because Peter's father's name is actually John. Okay, so the other Gospels record as Simon, son of John. Pretty weird stuff. Is this some kind of error in the Bible that we've located? Maybe Jesus forgot who Peter's father was and became mentally confused. Or maybe Matthew's playing fast and loose with the facts and just making something up. Well, think about this. I've just told you the background twice. Not once, but twice in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus has answered the Pharisees' demand for an undisputable sign from heaven, and both times Jesus has given them the sign of Jonah. Directly after this second time, which we're getting to here, he warns the disciples to beware the teaching of the Pharisees. And then right after that, in our text today, for the first time, someone proclaims who Jesus really is, that he is the Messiah himself, and that person, Simon. And Jesus says, Simon, son of Jonah, flesh and blood did not reveal this to you. Now, this might not be true, because you've got to think this through for yourself, but it seems to me that Jesus is saying, Simon, you are finally breaking free from being a Jonah boy. Okay? You're finally breaking out of the thought patterns of the Pharisees, because you have the link with the Pharisees and Jonah. Okay? He's breaking out of this thought pattern. He says, the Father has shown this to you, right? Not flesh and blood. It's not just people, because he knows how everyone's thinking. Okay, he's breaking out of this. Finally, it's like Jesus is saying, the kingdom project can actually take off. Now, I can't help but read, you notice from my reading, that Jesus seems to be really excited about what he's saying to Peter. It seems to me he's like a parent whose kid is finally grown, and he can see he's ready to be entrusted with the family business. Like he's saying, Peter, take the keys. You can do this, right? Smash the gates of hell. You've become a rock-solid foundation to build on, Peter. As the disciples begin to understand who Jesus is and what he's about, he's excited to entrust to them the kingdom project of binding and loosing. Because this is kind of the whole point, right? Jesus came to get disciples, to train disciples, and to send disciples out into the world. And he's finally getting that major moment of where they begin to understand. Okay? Now, I think that binding and loosing is what we've been talking about all along. So loosing, I take as being opening the door for heaven to break in so that the kingdom can come on earth as it is in heaven. Okay? Loosen, to open. And binding, it seems to me, is closing the door, like closing the door on the devil. Now, the example is this word to bind is used explicitly only once of Jesus binding the devil, okay? Binding the strong man. So it's locking the door, okay? Closing it up. And so, and I think that this is the call of the kingdom project for everyone who knows Jesus. But given that, granted that, then you have to ask yourself, how would you know which doors are which? Right? What do you bind in life and what do you loose? What does that look like practically? Okay, well, let's go on in the text. Verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Very interesting. Look at this. Peter the rock is given the keys to the kingdom, and the first thing he does is turns from a rock to build on to a block to stop the kingdom's advancement. Right? You ever had your pinnacle moment and then you just butchered it? Right? That's always my nightmare, you know, before I get up here and speak, right? Well, no wonder Jesus didn't want his disciples to go around telling everyone their version of him being the Christ. Remember, right before that, he says, "Yeah, you know, you see that I'm the Christ. Okay, don't tell anybody." Right? Why? Because he knows they still don't understand it. Well, Peter fully believes that Jesus is the Messiah, which means the King. He still does not understand the kingdom means and method. Okay? No use in having the keys to bind if the first thing you bind is the kingdom's advancement and you close heaven's door, right? I give you the keys, you lock out heaven, like, okay, let's start over here, Peter, okay? So what's the holdup? Now notice the words. Jesus says he must go to Jerusalem to suffer. Now, why must Jesus go and suffer? Okay, now, but I need you to answer this according to the movie that we're in, okay? Because we're in a narrative. So think about the movie. What compels Jesus to enter the world's pain such that he must suffer? What would it be? Go ahead, John. What's that? Yes, absolutely, John. That is correct, okay? I'm looking for something beyond that, but that is true. All the pain, right? The pain's there. What is propelling him forward into the pain? Compassion. Yeah, compassion, right? We've talked about that. Now, we often think that it's just some logical system that God just had, okay, here's the facts, man. God linearly set this thing up, so I must do it. But he must suffer because he's Yahweh's son, his spitting image, the Father's own heart. He is the compassionate one himself. He must suffer because his passion is compassion. He cannot help but enter into other people's problems and make them his personal problem. You have to understand, this is the unchanging nature of God, is his character. This is who he is. Okay, and Jesus is the definition of God. But Peter still doesn't get it. He says, far be it from you, Lord, that this would happen. Interestingly, this wording, far be it, or God forbid, or whatever your translation says, it literally comes across as God be merciful. Okay, so it's an idiom, okay? God be merciful. Seems to me that Peter's been really listening. All of this mercy talk has broken into him, right? We've been talking about mercy forever now. But he still does not understand mercy's application. Peter has seen Jesus' compassionate healings and heard his teaching on mercy, and he's starting to think that means that all will be well. It's like he's saying, I got the keys, Jesus. You just gave me the keys. Don't worry about it. Right? Nothing bad's going to happen to us because God is merciful and he's on our side. Can you blame him for that? Aren't these disciples just like you and I? Like when I get who God is, that he's chock full of mercy, that means that I won't have to suffer, right? After all, as the major philosophical question goes, why would bad things happen to good pastors, right? Everybody's wondering that all the time, okay? Well, gosh, what about the Messiah himself? You don't get any better than the Messiah. See, the guy's perfect. Why would bad things happen to a perfect person? We forget that mercy, as explained by Jesus, isn't the exclusion of pain from our lives, but it is the action birthed from a heart that willingly enters into the pain. Okay, Peter wants a mercy that spares him and Jesus, but Jesus lives a mercy that shares suffering with others. Okay, these are two totally different religions. And so Jesus turns to Peter and says, get behind me, Satan. You're being a stumbling block, a tripping rock to me instead of a rock to build on. Why? He says, because you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but the things of humans. Now again, think about the movie we're in. What is the human way of thinking in the ancient world that Jesus is talking about? Yeah, it's a vice, right? Compassion is not a thing in the ancient world. They want to avoid it, okay? Now, what is the virtue that they're seeking in the ancient world? Okay, they're avoiding compassion because that's entering pain. What's the good way? What's the good life? Do you guys remember? It's the opposite, right? Which means, so compassion is to suffer. He's saying their virtue is to not suffer, which is apathy. I know that doesn't ring a bell to us because for us it's not a virtue. Like that's called not good, okay? So to not suffer is what they're looking for, to be untouched by the pain. And you got to understand, when you go that way, which is the temptation of all of us, right? I see something wrong, I'm like, okay, well, I'll be nice, but like I don't want it to take up my time. I don't want it to hurt me. You know, I don't want to get too involved with that kind of thing. But the problem is the Jonah starts to creep in, right? My comfort is my greatest desire, not the city, right? And the Pharisee starts to creep in. I'll legislate. I'll build rituals and things to protect my heart, right? I can be good. I don't have to enter in. So comfort becomes the concern, and you begin to feel self-pity, but no pity for the city. And your heart becomes locked up, right? People who worship God with their lips and their heart is far from him. So God be merciful. God be merciful easily becomes this cry for me, right? God be merciful to me. If you do something wrong, you know, God help you. Okay? It easily becomes a cry for me and mine. Right? Protect us, God. Leave everyone else to their own devices. Keep us safe from the world. The question is, though, right, do we fall into that mindset? Am I the only person here? Okay. Somebody, like, give me a show of hands here, guys. Okay. Okay. So people do fall into this mindset. This is real. Now we have to ask ourselves, I fall into this mindset. Is that what the kingdom keys are for? Right? So we can lock out the pain. I'm good. Is that what they're for? Let's find out what they're for, because Jesus will go on. Verse 24. Then Jesus told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he's done. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now, I want you to think about this. Think about the big, big movie that we've been in, okay? Because all of this is connected. Think about this. Jesus ate with sinners, right? Okay, and he gave mercy. He's talked about that over and over. And forgiveness, unexpectedly. And what did they say to him? What did the religious people say to him? Yay, Jesus! What was their reply to all that? Yeah, die. Yeah, die. What else? What did they call him? What's that? Yeah, a glutton and a drunkard. All these things are true. Okay, and the pinnacle thing that they come out with is they called him a devil. Right? So, and all of that culminates in this. They call him a devil. But what does Jesus call demonic? What Jesus calls demonic is when someone tries to prevent him from his passion of compassion, reaching out to the broken world that's reeling in agony and pain. As John said, if the world's trapped in sin, what will this God do? He will come to save. Okay. Now, why did they think that Jesus is a devil? Because he's doing all sorts of good things, right? Now, they thought that of Jesus. Why does he think they're a devil? It seems to me Jesus is saying, you can be certain of this. It is the devil that deals in self-preserving and self-serving goodness. Why? The way the devil tricks us is he tricks us into thinking it will work, but the trick is it will never actually change anything. It's a master plan that has no intention of actually changing the world. And it's a lie that is easy to buy because it's meant to make me look good and feel good. Okay, and I don't know if you guys have seen social media anytime, ever, but people put on there from their life what makes them look good and looks like they feel good at least, right? Okay, this is, we all get caught in the delusion of this, man. I get caught up in it the same as everybody else. So it's a lie that we buy. Because it makes me look good and feel good. But it's fool's gold because it can never make me good for the sake of others. It doesn't work because it won't do good when it costs. This religion tells me I should be spared because I'm good. You're like, nothing bad should happen to me. I'm good. I shouldn't even have to enter into the mess and the pain of people that aren't good. The most easy realm for this is financial, okay? If you're good with your finances and someone's bad with their finances, I don't want to give them money, right? Like, that's the feeling. Like, you're bad with your finances. Pull it together, man. Not, hey, I'll give some of mine to help build you up, right? It's the easiest realm to think about it. See, the devil duped us into thinking that he is just bad. He only works in the bad. I don't do bad things, so the devil's nowhere in my life. Right? If I just avoid the bad. But we don't understand that he twists the good. You see, the Pharisees were great at following the rules, but they wouldn't go beyond them into the suffering of others. They used the rules, we've said this before, to keep themselves from having to suffer. Jesus is reminding Peter again that self-protecting goodness doesn't open the door to heaven. It actually blocks the way. It locks it out. Now, I want to give you an example of this. The other day, I was talking to a woman who has no home. And long story short, she said this. She said, she's at the church here. She's chatting with me. She says, I like it here. Okay. I wish I would have come when I had a home. I have no nice clothes. I got no place to clean up and get presentable. Maybe I could come and sit outside and listen in. And I said, you got to understand, none of us are good enough or clean enough or presentable enough to be here at church. That's not what it's about. I said, that's not the point. Not that we're good enough for God or have earned our place, but that God is so good that when we weren't good enough, he gave his life for us. This is what Christianity is about. And she took a long pause and said something that stunned me. She said this. She said, I always thought church was for people who are already good. Isn't that interesting? For people who are already good. People who are put together. Now, it got me thinking again. How is it that this woman does not think she's good enough, put together enough, or worth enough to show up at church? Because Jesus says that we have been entrusted with the kingdom keys. Think about the context here. If we play the Pharisees' goodness game of performance and being better than and worth it, this woman literally has no place, and she knows it and named it straight to my face. You see, we cannot get caught up in this so easy game of promoting our perfect image. Jesus says the opposite of that is taking up the cross. Now, we don't take up the cross to be good enough, right? Or to be better than somebody else, but to be good for the sake of others. This woman does not think she is as good as me or even good enough to show up. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, will she ever know the glory of this totally different kind of Father that we get to know? Because Jesus says he is coming in the Father's glory, and he explains that first and foremost, that glory looks like the cross. So will this not good enough, not put together enough, not enough to ever be on the inside woman, ever hear of the glory defined by this cross-taking God? This is the question I have to ask myself. Talking to her really, really impacted me. And since then, I've honestly wondered, I had to ask myself, am I building an untouchable, polished, good-looking life? Or do I really have the courage to become the touchable life of the self-giving God of the cross? because she knows she has no chance in this game. You see, when we get caught up in that, you have to understand, we're people. We buy this so easy. They sell it to us on social media. They sell it to us in religion. It was sold in the ancient world. It's the same game, okay? Because the devil is crafty. He knows how to sell a good game, okay? And the Pharisees bought this game. They wanted to be somebody in this world. They wanted to prove they were good enough, clean enough, pure enough, and wanted everyone to know it. They were seeking what Jesus says is the award. They wanted to gain the world. But Jesus warns, he says, you get what you seek. If you want to be worth the world, you can be. You absolutely can be worth the world. You can. But here's the irony. You were worth so much more than that. I promise you this. There is no name you can gain that could be greater than the name God wants to give you by pure grace. I promise you that. This is the Babel hinge of the story, right? At Babel, they want to make a great name. God says to Abraham, I'll give you a name. Okay? You can never, ever, ever make a name greater than the name God gives. By performing for your worth, you commodify yourself, your life, your psuche, as Jesus calls it, and you lose sight of what you are actually worth. Jesus warns you, the very thing you are seeking to save, you will lose it. Were Jesus talking about biological life? There's different Greek words for these things. Merely your physical life. If Jesus was saying, man, you got to give up your life, you might never have to take the cross. Okay, because I don't know if I'm going to die for God. There's a good chance I'm not. Okay, I'm probably not going to be in that scenario. So do I get off the hook of taking up my cross? Okay, but Jesus is talking about our psuche, our self that we pursue, this kind of life, our life we're seeking to gain or make, our value. Jesus is reminding us not that we could one day maybe choose to die, but that we are choosing every day to gain a self or to give a self. But keep this in mind. If you must gain yourself, if that's your objective, you can only ever be worth your efforts. Anyone know what that feels like? The hamster wheel. I've never played that game, no. Right? It's exhausting. And even worse, think about this. Everyone knows that feeling of, I'll be somebody someday. Well, imagine you're to win that game. You're the man. You're the woman. You're important. You're better than. You're the best. Imagine you were to win. Were you to be included in the heart of the Father because you earned it, man? You deserved it. You were self-made. You were good enough and great enough and presentable enough. What would that do for every single other person beneath you? What does it do for the woman who isn't enough to win? It tells her what she already believes, that she is worth less than you. You see, we as the church, this isn't just a Peter thing. We get the keys to the whole enterprise. Okay? You do have the keys. You all have the keys. You do. And never forget that those keys are always and forever cross-shaped keys. We must remember that, yes, 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 I'm not saying, well, we should all be bad people and not do good things or never learn to be good. We're learning to be good, yes. But we are learning to be good for others, not better than others. And Jesus says we have to remember this and understand the kingdom project, because he is going to come and repay us. Which sounds like the most ominous thing of all time. Now, please, guys, we have to hear these words, but we have to understand them in context. These words do not mean that God is going to come and berate us for every wrong we have done. If that were true, and if you read things this way, it tells you the game you're in, because it puts you right back in the performance game. If he says, step outside of the performance game, but don't mess up or I'm coming for you. Like, slightly mixed messages there, Jesus. Okay? It puts us back in the performance game. That brings the Pharisee right back in, focusing on our faults. Right? Heavens, no! Please go and listen to Alan's last super impactful sermon there last week if you start hearing your faults again. He said, you got the wrong message. No, okay. We've made this into such a legislative story. I got to tell you, Jesus is not tallying perfection. He is not tallying perfection, but he is stating the needed change of direction for people with the kingdom keys. He is not coming to test the flawless, but he is teaching us God's way of being selfless. He's letting us know that giving up our pursuit of a great name seems to cost us everything, but that the worth and dignity he gives back to us for entrusting him far surpasses the greatness we could have ever sought to gain. I think that's why he's telling the disciples that some of them will see it before they taste death. Because what do they see in their lifetime? Remember, a thing is worth whatever someone will pay for it. And from here on out in Matthew, Jesus is going to the cross. And he will show them what they are worth to him, even at the cost of his life. I want to reflect on it this way. We all get caught up in this pursuit, right? We've said that, trying to be somebody, strive to earn it, to be better than. I wonder what would happen if we as Christian people en masse stopped trying to prove that we're worth the world and instead sought to prove to others that they are worth the cross. I've gotten caught up so many times in my life in proving myself, but I'm starting to believe more and more through the book of Matthew that the kingdom really does come in the small, in the mustard seeds, in the messy moments of mercy, like sitting with someone who's hurting. That's not like the most entertaining time in the world. You know, when we sit with someone who's hurting, we're choosing to be for somebody and not just to keep the pain out. What about forgiving when it's hard? I mean, I've never forgiven when it's easy, so. Right? But when I forgive you, it means what you've done to me, I take the pain. I suffer. And I don't put it back on you. Right? What about sharing your time or sharing your space when it feels inconvenient, or even at all? Since after COVID, it is way harder to do. I don't know if you guys noticed this. That discomfort, though, how do I move past the comfort of my little vine to feeling like I can take some discomfort to bring comfort to somebody else? I'm starting to believe that these are the ways the kingdom comes. And that every choice, every single choice to enter into another person's pain instead of protecting our comfort really is God-given keys to open and release the door and power of heaven. Now, I just want to close by drawing out why this matters so much. Now, we've talked about a whole bunch of ethical stuff here. Why does this matter? To me, it's not because people can't possibly be good without God. To me, that's such a religious trope. Okay, I have so many great atheist friends. They're fantastic. Sometimes they outdo me in goodness. Okay, it's not because you can't be good without God. It's because none of our goodness actually matters without this God. Only this God tells me my willingness to do good to another and to take pain and to give up making my great name and to bless others at a cost actually, truly does good. I remember being in college and asking a professor, does our good do good? Right? Like you know, why should we be good? Well, because God says so. Yeah, but why should we be good? Because God says so. Yeah, but why should we? Because God says so. Okay, does our good actually do good? No. Because if your end of your story is the whole world burns, your good doesn't do good. It's anemic. It's just ticking boxes. It can't do anything. Do you see what I'm saying? The question is, why does this matter? Does your good do good? Only this God claims it does good. It actually transforms. It's not just an ethical system or tick boxes in the sky to prove that God should love me, because why else would I do good if it doesn't do any good? It's not so that he'll love me, but because he loves me, he gives me the keys. So when I act, he acts with me in my acts, in new creation power. And he promises me that even when I don't see it, that's what he's been talking about, even when I don't see it, the mustard seeds are there, man. Do you look for them? Right? His love, leaven, is hidden in it. And it will grow, and it will show that what I did wasn't wasted. That what you gave up when you could have gained was never wasted. That when you kept your heart open, God knows this is hard, you kept the door open for heaven to break in. And Jesus says it does break in. And it is breaking in, and it will break in. That's why he says to them, on the third day, I'm going to rise. And does that matter? Right? That's the whole shebang, man. Not so that we could go to heaven, but to prove that heaven will irrevocably bind itself to earth. That's the resurrection, right? The binding to earth, flesh and spirit unified. Heaven proving that the cost of a heart that faces the pain really, truly does open heaven's door, and that we find out death and hell really never stood a chance, man. And if you believe that, if you actually believe that your good does resurrection good, you can stop anxiously striving to do good to prove yourself and instead prove to yourself and to everyone else that heaven really does want this earth at any cost. And know that God, this God then has captured your heart and made your heart his own kind of heart. Do you see the difference? What we do actually matters. It actually boots on the ground, tangibly recreates the world. It matters. And that's key to understanding why Jesus can promise that all you're giving, even through the pain, will be shown to be of unimaginable gain. Amen.
Amen.
Let me just pray, guys. God, I want to pray for a goodness revolution. That we would see the good as new creation goodness. It seems to me that Paul really understood this, and he picks it up there in Ephesians, where he talks about how you're going to do more than we could ever ask or even imagine by the power that is at work within us, because you, God, rose from the dead. And it is your resurrection life that is in us, and that death and hell never really stands a chance against that. God, I just want to pray that we would be hope people, that we would be death destroyers, that we would be light bringers, that we would understand the hope of our calling and the power of your resurrection, and that we would know that is practical and it can come into our workplace and our family and the grocery store even today. In Jesus' name, amen.